This is the fourth day of this January 2015 Rohatsu 7-day session. And we'll return to the collected talks of Japanese Zen master Basui from the 14th century. And our text is called Mud and Water. The book is called Mud and Water. It's translated by Arthur Braverman. Questioner. It is said that when looking at the sayings and teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, if you look at them as one with fresh hatred looks upon an enemy, you will then for the first time be able to understand them. What do you think about this? So apparently there was a saying, warning monks not to become attached to the sayings of the masters, and that they should look at these sayings as if you were an enemy. You're looking at your enemy with hatred. It's just a hyperbole, obviously, as a way to try to pry the monks free of their attachments to the words so that they might confirm the words through their own direct experience. But let's hear from Basui. He says, the way is a fundamental part of everybody. Its essence is to penetrate enlightenment and to leave no trace of this attainment. If I were to explain this fundamental part, even the one word awaken would add waves to a level surface. How much more so with sayings and teachings? One who holds on to the residue and cannot grasp the real cuts himself off from the source in the end. Notice here he says, the essence of the way is to penetrate enlightenment and to leave no trace of this attainment. Don't hold on to any idea of it as an attainment. And if it is genuine enlightenment, then it won't be seen as an attainment in the first place, because you realize that it's something that is common to everybody, something we've always had, that we always are, have been. But this strong emphasis in Zen on no matter what kind of insight we have, from the tiniest little philosophical or psychological insight, little insight about something about our personality, all the way up to true enlightenment itself, our job is to just let go of it. Discard it. Get rid of it. It serves no purpose. The it here means the thought of it, the memory of it. We can't let go of the experience. That's us. We are the experience. But then there is the thought, and that's what stains the experience. He continues, Buddha nature, the self of all beings, is the simple truth as it is. It transcends sects and rules. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds can't explain it. The commentaries on the treasury of the teachings discussed during the lifetime of Shakyamuni Buddha can't catch hold of it either. Again, words are no substitute for experience. Even the most eloquent, most powerful words are words. They're just the finger pointing to the moon. It's not the moon itself. Even the Buddhas of past, present, and future can't explain it. What kind of thing would it be if it could be explained? Its full function has no equal. The speed of a flint spark can't compare with it. Lightning can't even penetrate it. Its activity has no fixed direction. Thinking it is rising in the east, it sinks in the west. Thinking it is rising in the south, it sinks in the north. It makes thunder roar in clear, fine weather, and flames arise at the bottom of the sea. Incomprehensible? Absolutely. Inconceivable? Yes. Beyond conception, concepts. It's a famous Zen utterance. On top of a flagpole, a cow gives birth to a calf. It's not what you think. Again, he continuing to talk about this true nature of ours. It is the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving, and the master that raises the hands and propels the legs. From the Buddhas and ancestors down to insects, of all things that possess essential nature, who would not receive its favor? In other words, it's common to all imaginable creatures, things. And then he says, what of you people? Do you know yourselves? When you doubt sufficiently, your enlightenment will be sufficient. Doubt here, of course, means when you question, when you wonder deeply enough, your enlightenment will be sufficient. When you have true aspiration, even if you didn't want to doubt, your whole body will be filled with doubt. Even if you don't seek expedient practices, your mind will not busy itself with miscellany. Though you don't want to eliminate them, you will be rid of the 10,000 things. Though you don't choose to discard them, reading sutras and commentaries and all kinds of activities will naturally be eliminated. Profit and loss, good and bad, all will be obliterated. Like one who is stricken with severe illness and is about to die, whose mind doesn't distinguish friends from enemies, when you travel, you will forget you are walking. When you are eating, you will be unaware of the taste. When you are sitting, you will forget you are sitting. Forgetting your body, you will not lie down. If in this way you become a part of this doubt, in a short time you will inevitably experience great enlightenment. He's talking here about an extraordinarily deep state of absorption and questioning. Few of us will ever experience that kind of questioning for any sustained period of time. For most of us, it comes and goes, but it only takes seconds for that questioning to turn into awakening. No one need be discouraged because you haven't experienced what he's talking about. It can come in an instant without any warning. You're suddenly gripped with questioning of the mu. Who am I? What is it? And then it's out of your hands. It's just something much greater, some force that has taken over. And you just ride it. As he says, if you don't, even if you don't want to question, your whole body will be filled with questioning. There's no effort behind it. There's no working at it. When he says even if you don't want to eliminate the 10,000 things, you will be rid of them. He's talking about this realm of mental phenomena. He's talking about samadhi, a deep samadhi, where you are free of the binding nature of mental phenomena and physical phenomena. We transcend all of these things. There's no interest in such a state of samadhi to be reading commentaries, not to mention other kinds of popular writing, all the stuff that comes across through the media. He says profit and loss, good and bad, will all be obliterated. That is, we transcend it all. It recedes. These any notions of getting something or losing anything, of good or bad, it's no longer an issue. It's all just evaporates. And when you walk, you forget you're walking. When you eat, you're unaware of the taste. When you're sitting, you forget you're sitting. Everyone in this sesshin has the means, the tool, to reach this kind of absorption. Usually it comes unexpected. Suddenly we find ourselves in it, in this state, free of all such phenomena, thoughts, problems, self and other, this and that, gone. For someone who's working on Mu, it's just a matter of becoming so absorbed in Mu that Mu, in effect, squeezes all of these concerns out of the mind. It just occupies, it takes over the mind, this absorption in Mu. The same with any koan, the same with the breath. It is not so difficult to approach this state of samadhi, where we feel the sense of oneness and losing concerns about things that usually concern us, seeing thoughts recede. But as we approach true, complete absorption, it becomes more difficult. And what can make the difference is self-discipline, keeping the eyes down, maintaining silence, surrendering to the guidelines of the sesshin, just giving up one's preferences, just moving, flowing with the whole structure. So the whole point of all of these rules and guidelines is so that we don't have to be concerned about our preferences. We don't have to be making decisions. We just let go, turn ourselves over to the flow of the schedule from one thing to another. And he quotes one of his predecessors. Let's see if it says who it is here. Well, no one whose name I recognize. So I'll say it: Sozan Honjaku. Sozan Honjaku, 9th century Japanese master. An ancient said, "To care for this matter as your own, be like one who, passing through a village which has been infected with destructive rice worms, will not even wet his throat with a drop of water. Then you will attain it." Then Basui comments, "Thus, if you want enlightenment, abandon to its depths all ordinary attachment to deeds and behavior, principles and obligations, opinions and interpretations. Be as before the birth of your mother and father, separate from all external phenomena, neither sinking into internal quiet nor settling in the void. Look directly. Now, as you are listening, tell me, what is it that listens?" Let's run through those again. Abandon to the depths of enlightenment all ordinary attachment to deeds. Okay, so thoughts about what you're doing, what you will do, what you have done, give it all up. To Mu. Deeds and behavior. Principles. Principles. So many people are so proud to say that they have their principles. Principles are ideas. They're concepts. They're abstractions. Principles and obligations, opinions. That's the one of the biggest obstacles for us as Americans, with our tremendous pride in our opinions. Interpretations, more abstractions. And then he says, be as before the birth of your mother and father. I would add before consciousness itself stirs. Neither sinking into internal quiet nor settling in the void. Settling in the void just means attachment to the idea of emptiness. Sinking into internal quiet is a growing danger now in these next few days of Sesshin, where people can find the quiet, the internal quiet, so seductive that they can settle into this quietude and not want to go beyond it. The quietude, the tranquility of the mind is just a stage that sets the the context or prepares the mind to go beyond that. It's nothing about quiet by itself that offers any discovery. There has to be vitality in our sitting. There has to be a wanting to go beyond just deep calm. We don't want to be lulled into just a deep calm that is a conditioned state. When Sesshin ends, it'll disappear. What's beyond that quiet? This takes the strongest aspiration to not want to settle for just this deep tranquility, because it's so wonderful by contrast with our ordinary daily lives. It is so alluring to reach this state. For some people, they've never even experienced such calm before. And people with a lesser aspiration will just be satisfied to sit there and enjoy it. He quotes Rinzai, Linchi, "This physical body of yours, composed of the four great elements, can't hear the Dharma. Your spleen, stomach, liver, and gallbladder can't hear the Dharma. The empty sky can't hear the Dharma. Then what does hear it? Just let go from the overhanging cliff and investigate thoroughly." This is a practice in its own kind of inquiry. Who is hearing? You make every sound into that question, who or what is hearing? Questioner, I hear that all the successive ancestors point directly to people's minds, causing them to look into their inherent nature and attain Buddhahood. I also hear that looking at one's self is as intense as hatred for an enemy. What is the meaning of this? Basui, in the self there are the true and the false. Here, he's using the word self as our nature, our self-nature. There is the true and the false. The conscious mind is the false. Buddha nature is the true. Now let me pause to comment on the translator's use of this phrase, the conscious mind. I would prefer to say the discriminating mind. That is the functions of which are seated in our prefrontal cortex, that also is the seat of all of our executive functions. So I'm just going to substitute. Each time he says the conscious mind, I'm going to say the discriminating mind. Another phrase you read sometimes is the small self, the intellect, that which divides, analyzes, judges, so forth. All of those functions of the discriminating mind. He said, he's saying the discriminating mind is the false. False in that it's limited in its function. It's just a fragment of our true mind. Remember Roshi Kaplow quoting Yasutani Roshi as holding up a ballpoint pen and saying, if this pen represents your true mind, the discriminating mind is no more than the ball, the tip of the pen. Zen Master Dogen said, you think that your mind is thoughts and concepts, but actually, it is mountains and rivers, grasses and stones. So we're going to be, Dogen will continue to talk about this discriminating mind. When you awaken to your true nature, you cut off the roots of the wheel of transmigration, manifest your many inherent virtues, and make contact with others, bringing benefit to their lives. This is seeing into your inherent nature and attaining Buddhahood. The root of life and death is the discriminating mind. Beginning practitioners mistakenly take things like the emission of light and the performance of miracles, which are really the roots of ignorance, for the clear expression of Buddha nature. It's so easy to misinterpret these, what we would call in Zen, makyo, these states of mind, to think that those are manifestations of something extraordinary. An ancient said, students of the way don't realize the truth because they dwell on the discriminating mind of the past. The seed of birth and death through endless eons is what fools call the true original self. They dwell on this phrase, they dwell on the conscious mind of the past. I'm guessing that what he means by that, or the discriminating mind of the past, is kind of an allusion to how our sense of self is based on this conditioned mind of thoughts about ourselves, memories about ourselves, associations, things that people have said to us, ways people have reacted to us, that all of this over years and years has a way, these thoughts and images and memories have a way of congealing, and maybe that's what he means by dwelling on the discriminating mind of the past. The seed of birth and death is what fools call the true original self. In all Buddhist writings, or many Buddhist writings, you run across these references to birth and death, the root of life and death. This is just that which, it's the engine of karma. He continues, the discriminating mind is the boss of notorious robbers, the origin of the 10 evil deeds, and the pit of knowledge based on attachment to form. If it is not destroyed, though you were to speak wonderful words of the miraculous, they would all be no more than strange spirits of wild foxes. In the end, you wouldn't be able to avoid floating in the world of transmigration. That's why its destruction is connected with the one great matter. Whenever he says destruction here, obliteration, obliterating or destroying this discriminating mind, of course he means seeing through it. You don't need to destroy anything. We just—it's just a manner of speaking, a phrase he uses. It's just seeing the very limited nature of this discriminating mind beyond it into our true mind. He goes on, the reason for transmigration through the six realms of existence, from the beginningless beginning to the present, tossing and turning in great pain, is that you can't turn off this discriminating mind. The tree of swords and the mountain of blades are born of it. Here he's talking about the sort of all mythological images of hell that you find in some popular Buddhist texts. The tree of swords and the mountain of blades are born of it. The boiling kiln and burning coal come from it also. The demons and devils, too, come from nowhere else. The beast with hair and horns is no other than a product of this discriminating mind. Though there are new heads and different faces, some dying here and being reborn there, though there may be retribution from various results of causes, some becoming beautiful, some becoming ugly, all are a result of nothing other than the discriminating mind. Again, the engine of karma, this discriminating mind. Karmic afflictions, karmic attachment, suffering. Though it is said never to have form, it is like fire which kindles flame in firewood when the proper contact is made. If this contact no longer exists, quiet sets in. When it moves, again, the discriminating mind, it is like clouds and mist appearing. When it is under control, it is like the clear blue sky. So, you see, he's getting right in there with the very point where we work, is noticing when the discriminating mind is at work and turning our attention away from it, back to what we could call no mind, the mu, the breath. This is no mind. When we are 100% absorbed in this realm of no mind, the breath or the koan, then we are free of this discriminating mind. He continues, as long as practitioners of the way haven't eradicated their discriminating minds, all their activities and words are the deeds of karmic consciousness. They are not in accord with the way. Whether they are bright or dull, knowledgeable or ignorant, thoughtful or thoughtless, with or without desires, whether they use expedient means or study the direct teachings, whether they are venerated or held in contempt, whether they perform miracles and have feelings of love and pity, these are, after all, activities of the discriminating mind. When it is cold, all heaven and earth are cold. When it is hot, all heaven and earth are hot. When there is justice, everything is just. When there is evil, everything is evil. When you stop the movement of the discriminating mind and realize the way of no mind, whether you practice rightly or wrongly, speak or remain silent, are active or quiet, the I is never there. All is the turning of the right Dharma wheel. So that's another, maybe a somewhat cruder way of referring to what this translator renders as a conscious mind or discriminating mind, is the I, the ego, the self, small s. From the outset, that it has never been evil and good with regard to the Dharma. Evil and good simply exist when you are trying to destroy the discriminating mind, and you still haven't done so. Here, let me just comment on that. Evil and good simply exist when you're trying to destroy the discriminating mind and you still haven't done so. In other words, you make an enemy of this discriminating mind, an opponent. That won't work. The only way to obliterate, so-called, this discriminating mind is withdraw our attention from it. To put our attention so completely on the breath or the koan that this discriminating mind just gives up. If you clearly eliminate the drunken mind, drunken rages will instantly stop and mind and body will be calm and quiet. If you want to recover completely from your illness, then stay free when sitting, lying down, and when doing walking meditation, and don't rely on another's power. Just stop your wandering. Look penetratingly into your inherent nature, and concentrating your spiritual energy, sit in zazen and break through to the true self. Then you will, for the first time, attain liberation. If you simply try to stop the movement of consciousness and consider this enlightenment, it will be like searching for a fish, considering it a jewel, or searching after a robber and treating him as your child. This will put an iron wall between you and enlightenment. It will be a hateful traitor damaging the Dharma treasure. When our practice is yet to mature, we treat this discriminating mind, this self notion, we treat it as the enemy. We try to overpower it or destroy it or conquer it. But that's really not going to work. We have to just not nourish it with our attention, not nourish this I, this me, this my, not feed it. And it doesn't work just to decide. It wouldn't work just to decide, okay, I'm not going to do that. Okay, I'm not. We need something else. The koan, the breath. We need something else to pour all of our attention into. And then it happens. It doesn't work to try to not do something. We just have to make it all this affirmative, complete absorption in this one simple practice that we're working on. And give all our attention to that. Questioner, today I realize for the first time that all these years I've been searching after a robber and treating him as my child. You know, these allusions in Chinese and Japanese texts, these allusions to robbers are so common that must have had a lot more salience to people of those times than does to us. I think most of us, this rings a little hollow. Searching after a robber and treating him as my child, mistaking the false for the real. Though I may see my mistake, if I do not actually destroy this discriminating mind myself, the moment of liberation will never arrive. With what expedient means will I rid myself of it? In other words, how do I do it? Tell me how to do it. I'm game. Just tell me how to do it. Vasui says, there is no particular expedient means. If you just detach from all forms in your mind and don't fall into the pit of formlessness, liberation will manifest in your body as it is right now. So Vasui, this was his style of teaching. He didn't get into the mechanics, at least not that we see in these talks. But many other masters, most other masters do. They very much get into exactly what to do and using our practice, our particular practice, as a tool. And that's how we detach from all forms in the mind, all thoughts, and don't fall into the pit of formlessness. This is the trap of getting caught in a state of emptiness. Emphasis on the caught, because we must ultimately see the formlessness of all forms, the no-thingness of things. But if we make a thing out of emptiness or formlessness, then that's another trap. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.